our studios in Cuenca, Spain, I'm Kate Jetmore with Listen, the podcast that highlights the common threads that run through different cultures and unite us as human beings. We're thrilled to bring you the third and final conversation in our series on religion and spirituality. In today's interview, we'll be talking about the call to serve as clergy, the practical steps that must be taken to get there, and the thin line that exists between politics and religion. My guest today is Rachel Hayes. As a Unitarian Universalist minister, she serves a congregation in Amherst, Massachusetts. She is spending the pandemic learning how to minister to people she can't share space with and walking her dog, Yuli, a lot. Welcome, Rachel. Thanks so much for joining us today.
It's really good to be with you, Kate.
As we said in the intro, you are a full-time Unitarian Universalist minister with your own congregation in Massachusetts. But if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you to take us back to the beginning of your story, if you would. Tell us where you grew up and what role religion and spirituality played in your childhood.
Well, I grew up in a Roman Catholic family, mm-hmm. and my dad's side of the family is mostly Catholic, and my mom's side is mostly Protestant, and she converted when they got married. Mm-hmm. So my primary religious influence was my family and going to Mass every Sunday and being very present in that way. And it was an all-the-time thing, always Catholic. But my mom still had her religious background that she came with too, and so a lot of songs that she learned when she was a kid going to church with her family came into my childhood, and like Swing Low Sweet Chariot was one of those. And like, we never sang that at church, but it was still part of my upbringing. Mm-hmm. So I grew up in Kentucky and I didn't learn this until I was in seminary, but Louisville was the first inland Catholic diocese.
Really?
Yeah, well, it was Bardstown, and then it moved to Louisville.
Okay.
And there were other like Jesuits doing other work, but so far as having an established diocese and that sort of setup, it was Louisville. So Louisville is so much more Catholic than anybody expects. Mm-hmm. And not that all the Christians there are Catholic, but it is much more in the norm than it is, say, in other places in the South to be Catholic.
And it sounds like there's a lot of history there too. Is that right?
Of Catholic history?
Yeah, like, I mean, I would imagine if it was the first inland diocese that, you know, the churches are older maybe than in some other cities that have a history of Catholicism.
Well, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting to watch the way history intersected through the Catholic Church. I did a paper on this in seminary because I was like, this is part of my upbringing that I never understood.
Yeah.
But in the course of 3 miles on one road, you might have three different parishes. So I think the span is actually like just under 2 miles or something. Three different parishes, all serving very different communities.
But all Catholic?
All Catholic. Uh-huh. And what this was the different waves of immigration. So you would have a German parish and an Irish parish and an Italian parish, and they didn't intersect.
Wow.
And so they would be located in the neighborhood that was further out and like that community was building. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really understand how that all fit together until I started to like look at waves of immigration to the city.
Yeah. Wow. It's almost like taking
it's all part of the same story.
Yeah. And it's almost like taking a look through, it's almost like a humanities class. Like you can't parse out the religion from the immigration and, you know, the history and the culture of the people who are practicing the religion.
Yeah. And that was part of, I think, my experience of how the city fit together. Mm-hmm. And people don't, people don't divide along ethnic lines for parishes anymore. It's just whatever neighborhood you're in. But knowing how this came about and who was resourced to build a stone church and who built a brick church and who built a wooden church that was replaced later.
Right.
And all of these different things are part of our story and they're around us all the time. And it's really easy to not have access to the history of it and still live with the effects of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Rachel, what about your personal experience in the Catholic Church? Did you tick all the boxes that a Catholic child ticks? I mean, did you?
Okay.
So talk to us about that.
So there was, there's all of the like common benchmarks of First Communion and confirmation. And I was an altar server. So this was the beginning of the 90s, and it was still slightly new, but not exotic to have girl altar servers. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel like I was breaking any sort of stained glass ceiling on that. But it was really meaningful to me, and and part of it's like, children like to light candles.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's very special to be the one who gets to light the candles. Mm-hmm. And so I did that when I was in fourth and fifth grade. So there was all of sort of the usual benchmarks. And this is like before high school, which starts a different part of the story. Mm-hmm. But I also, like, my family was very involved at church. And my, like, I was in the children's choir. I think both of my parents at different times served on parish council, but I'm not entirely sure that that's true. I know, like, but my dad was and still is a lector, which means he reads like first and second readings in the mass, and he's also sung in the choir since I was little, and it's like I remember times where like you don't need to get a babysitter to go to choir rehearsal. You just bring your kid and tell them they have to be good because it's church. and so, like, I remember hanging out and playing with all the other choir kids and just trying not to make too much noise. And sometimes, like, there weren't a whole lot of other choir kids, and my brother and I were kind of, like, playing hide-and-seek in the pews while the choir rehearsal's going on. Or, but also the Passion readings for Holy Week are frequently divided up into parts. And they would have rehearsal. in advance. And I remember going to some of those rehearsals when my dad had one of the parts. And like, as a theater person, I feel like until I was in high school, I saw more theater in church than I did in a theater, because I knew every year it was going to come around and we would have the passion again. And like the parish we went to for all of my elementary school years was incredibly theatrical in the way they did this. Like somebody was in the back hammering railroad spikes for nailing Jesus to the cross. And it was like a really like powerful sensory experience.
And would you say, Rachel, that was kind of your in with the church? I mean, was that when you became, you know, less of a kid who was kind of passing the time while her dad was singing with the choir and more of a participant?
I mean, I don't remember ever not being a participant. And part of it was that it is easy in that like corporate body to, like, as soon as you're aware, like, kneel when people kneel and stand when people stand and learn the words that you hear every week and say them along with everybody else.
Right.
And it's really empowering for a child in like, or at least a kid like me. It was like, I am just as much of a person in this setting as any of the grownups. And that was really cool.
Yeah. You mean because the structure and the ritual was so familiar and you knew what all the steps were? Is that what you mean?
Yes. And I think especially after my first communion, and I could like participate in every part of a regular Sunday mass. Like there was no barrier to participation at that point. And part of it was, yes, I know how to do the things. I know how to be in this place. but I, like, at a certain point, they tried having, a children's church with simplified readings and an activity, and like they would break you out and then bring you back right before communion, I think. And I hated it. And
so tell me about that. Why did you hate it? What did you hate it because it was called kids' church, or did you hate it because it was actually kind of dumbed down?
I really felt like it was watered down, and the adults were getting a real homily and were getting ideas, and I was supposed to color.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I'm like, and what the thing that was so wonderful, or one of the many things that was so wonderful about the regular church experience, was that I did feel like I was just as important as anybody else in the room.
Right, right.
And when you're about 8, that's a big deal.
Yeah, yeah.
And then to be told that, like, it's that we're doing something different that's for you, and then it feels less adequate.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, I don't know that I felt like I understood everything that was happening with the adult mass. Mm-hmm. But I still belonged.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then to be told that, like, I didn't quite belong, so we're going to do something that's less interesting, it was so rude.
I'm sure that's what they were going for, right? When they came up with this wonderful idea. Now, I obviously at some point you left Louisville, and I want to ask you about that. Is there anything you want to add before we move on? Anything you want to add about your experience in Louisville?
Okay. Yeah. So I was very like active and participating. And then when I was in seventh grade, and this did not happen in church, this happened in a playground. But I had this experience where I had my eyes closed and I just felt connection.
Mm.
And it was, and I was seeing, but it was like, it was not like I see with my eyes.
Mm.
And I was in this cloud and everything was yellow. And it was like, the cloud is God and God is connection. And I really didn't have a lot of context for this or way to talk to other people about it.
Did you talk to anyone about it?
I talked to the director of religious education at my school,
mm-hmm.
Who was one of those people who had gone to seminary thinking he was going to be a priest, and then in his discernment decided that it was more important for him to have a family.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of this was, so he tried to have a conversation with everybody who was going through the confirmation process or would go through the confirmation process. And it was, but this was sort of just an informal conversation I had with him. Mm. And I mentioned that this had happened.
Did he give you any words for it, or did you already have words for it?
He affirmed that like this sounded real,
mm.
Which was incredibly helpful. And he told me that I should read about Teresa of Avila.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't, because like I didn't have access to any good books.
Oh, he should have handed you a book when he told you that.
I know. It's like, this is before the internet.
Right, right.
I couldn't just look her up. I had access to my school library.
Right.
And they didn't have good books about Catholic mystics.
Mm-hmm.
Like, or there might, like, I think I tried to look her up in like some sort of Lives of the Saints,
right.
But it was like, oh yes, she was a nun and was good at convincing people to be poor. And like,
and you're like, wait, like, where's the part that pertains to my experience in the on the playground?
Right.
So Rachel, at some point you did move away from Louisville. Was that because you went off to school?
Yeah. So I went to a Catholic high school,
mm-hmm.
And was taught by so many amazing people, including a lot of really wonderful nuns and ex-nuns. And this was, I think, my first real experience of feminism.
Mm-hmm.
So that also is really important. And just like feeling like women's power, mm-hmm. in that way, mm-hmm. was incredible. It was an all-girls school.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I got into theater and was very involved with building sets and being on the stage crew,
okay.
for the plays.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Bennington College in Vermont,
okay.
After I graduated, and thought I was going to do a lot of things there, and did, but my degree from Bennington was in theater.
Okay.
And I had started, I'd shifted my focus to directing by that point, but I never stopped liking the more technical aspects of theater. Like, I love playing with lights, mm-hmm. and all of that stuff. So that's what I left Kentucky 4. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I spent a year in Michigan living with my boyfriend and trying to get jobs in theater and really coming up with nothing for a year, working retail. Mm-hmm. And eventually got an internship at a theater in DC for the next year. Mm-hmm. Spent a year in DC doing a lot of theater. And by doing, I mean doing a lot of like admin and peripheral stuff, right, and not actually doing the mm-hmm. art. And then my boyfriend was in New York, so I moved to New York.
Okay.
And also, like, I was really into a lot of the theater that I was seeing in New York, and I was traveling to New York to see theater as well as visit my boyfriend. So I was excited mm-hmm. to sort of pick up those threads and keep going there. But it was like, it's never easy to make money in theater.
Yeah.
Like that's always been a problem.
Yeah.
But so I was also selling cheese at the farmer's market. Like the farmer would bring the cheese from the farm and then I would sell it. Mm-hmm. And I did that for a very long time and got really close to that farming family. I love them. Mm-hmm. The theater company that I worked for didn't. So I started working for them in 2007. And like just by the years, like you can start to see where this is going. 2008. The economy isn't great. And by 2010, it's really hit all of the granting organizations mm-hmm. cycles because they offer grants in multi-year right. cycles. And things got a lot harder. Mm-hmm. And it was... like, it was also, like, really emotionally hard mm-hmm. to work for this company that never has enough money and is feeling really in danger mm-hmm. all the time.
Mm-hmm.
After a while, realized that, like, theater in some ways had never been meeting my needs or meeting all of my needs, even when it felt like things were going mm-hmm. well. Because the sort of theater that I craved was a place of connection that was not just for, that was not just for a couple hours one night, but a community that continued.
Mm. It's interesting to hear you use the word community because it seems to me that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that simultaneously as you were realizing that that community was not something you were going to find through this theater company or through the theater in general, you were finding community through the farmer's market, through the farmer who was bringing the cheese for you to sell. And I think that you started attending services in New York, and that was a new path that you found yourself on.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that didn't, I didn't start attending services until like very, very late in this story. Mm-hmm. And it, I was having one of those like New York walking moments where I was going to a picnic in Central Park and it wasn't one of like my normal picnic spots. Mm-hmm. So I didn't already have an idea of how I wanted to get there. And I was walking and I saw this church. Uh-huh. and I looked over and I was like, I need to go to that church next weekend.
Wow.
And I did. And it really was the sort of thing, like, I'd been in this neighborhood for years and never been on that block.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Right. Yeah. And that's such a New York thing.
Totally.
It's like, oh no, I don't walk on that block. And then something changes and you do, and you see this whole world that you've never seen before.
Right. Right.
I went to the service the next Sunday and just immediately felt like I was home and needed to be there.
Mm. Wow, those are big words.
Yeah.
And was this Unitarian Universalist?
Yes. Yeah, this is a Unitarian Universalist church. And my mom had been attending a Unitarian Universalist church in Louisville, like starting when I was in college.
Okay, so this wasn't your first experience with them?
No, and I would go with her to church sometimes when I was at home, or I would go with my dad sometimes when I was at home to his Catholic mm-hmm. church. And, but it never felt like my thing mm-hmm. until I decided to go by myself.
Yeah.
But I will say that the first time I attended church with my mom at her Unitarian church, there was a woman in the pulpit.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd never seen that before.
Right.
Growing up in the Catholic faith with all male clergy, like, mm-hmm. and there was something that, like, it was like something flipped on, like a connection was made mm-hmm. that had never been made before. And I didn't have any sort of like moment of calling at that point, but it was just like, it was like a new pathway was built or something.
Yeah, it sounds like possibility. Like it had never seemed like a possibility before, and now there was a possibility. Whether you chose to pursue it or not, it was on the table.
Right. And I didn't even feel it like personally. It was just there. Mm. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But that was exciting. But so I go into Fourth Universalist and
what was that block? What block were you on when that happened?
It's 76th and Central Park West.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. It's just south of the New York Historical Society and then the Museum of Natural History.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like you were really clear that it was time for a change and you had some idea of what direction you were being called in. Tell us a little bit about how you dealt with that crossroads.
So I was trying to get some clarity and figure everything out, and it was really hard in the middle of not knowing how to make sense of this theater career that isn't giving me what I need, and feeling suddenly very at home in a church, mm-hmm. And feeling very at home at the farmer's market too, mm-hmm. right? And so I'm looking at my life and like, so what's working? And like, well, I don't think this theater thing is working, but maybe I want to be a farmer. Mm-hmm. Or maybe I want to be a minister. And that's a much scarier thought than being a farmer.
Did you see those two choices as being similar in any way? Or did they seem as radically different as they seem on the face of it?
Well, they both seemed very natural. Mm-hmm. And so I understood the farming thing more in some ways than I did the ministry thing. Although I had an uncle who was a priest. So okay. Like a lot, that was my image of being a minister. Mm-hmm. But especially until I got very involved at church as an adult. Right. Like, that was my image of being a minister. Mm-hmm. But
so what practical steps did you take once these two possibilities were sort of floating in front of your eyes? What did you do?
Well, so I was like, I either need to go to seminary or figure out how to get land and sheep, because it was sheep I was most excited okay. about. And like, yes, there are lots of biblical connections there. And of course.
Did you see them at the time?
Yeah, but I also was like, I was very into knitting and felting and spinning, as much of that as you can do in a New York City apartment. Mm-hmm. And all of that. So I tried to, I was like, how am I going to know whether I actually like working with sheep?
Yeah.
So like any broke millennial, I was like, well, I have to get an internship.
And did you?
And I did. So I Googled sheep farm internship.
As one does.
Right. And the first thing that popped up was a monastery. But like the first Google result was a monastery.
And where was it?
It was on a small island off the coast of Washington State.
Okay.
And so I emailed, well, I looked at the pictures and I realized that, like, I knew this farm. I was seeing these pictures and I knew this farm. And it turns out that I had read an article about this monastery years before and actually cut out pictures from this magazine article and put them on a vision board.
And here you were, full circle.
Yeah. Yeah.
So did you go there? Did you go to that?
I did. So I visited and so I wrote and said, I'm interested in your internship setup. And I went and they invited me to come visit for a week.
Now, was it a Catholic monastery?
Yeah, yeah, wow. A Catholic monastery. Okay. Of Benedictine nuns.
Okay.
And they chant in Latin. Mm-hmm. And so very old school, right? So in a way, like, there was a real feeling of coming home in that too, because all of this Catholicism inside my body that I've like been trained from
all your
like, from
muscle
my
memory.
Pre-memory.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh yeah. So that was really, really amazing to even just go visit for that week. Mm-hmm. And then they tell me while I'm there, so one of the nuns is getting ready to have a knee replacement. Can you come next month? And I was thinking, oh yeah, we'll set this up and I'll have time to wrap things up in New York and then come next year.
Yeah.
No, they wanted me there the next month. And it's like all of that Catholic muscle memory when a nun asks me to do something that I don't have a good reason to say no to. I say yes to it.
Yes, ma'am.
So, and it's like, and I actually want to, right? It was like, of course, yes, I will do that. And I try to say yes to things that I don't have a good reason to say no to anyway. But when a nun asks me to do it, it's more automatic than normal. Right. And I said, well, I have this thing I have to do these dates in October. I could come after that.
Mm-hmm. And did you?
I did.
And how long gave were you there at the monastery?
6 months.
Wow.
Yeah. I really wanted to get the feel of the rhythm of time there. Yeah. And because like farming happens in an annual cycle.
Yeah.
And
what were the months you were there?
So I was there October through April. Okay. So end of October through the later part of April. Because I was there. I said that I would stay through lambing.
Mm-hmm.
And our last lambs were born on Easter.
Oh, I love it.
And... yeah, and so I didn't buy my tickets to leave until after the last lambs were born.
Okay, okay. Rachel, we need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back to hear more about your journey. We'll be back in a second.
Listen is sponsored by RAF, cutting-edge cuisine in a traditional setting. For a look at the RAF dining experience, visit www.rafsanpedro.es. That's www.rafsanpedro.es.
This is Kate Jetmore with Listen. If you're just joining us, my guest is Rachel Hayes, who is talking about being called to serve as a Unitarian Universalist minister. Rachel, I just want to go back a little bit. Earlier in our conversation, you were talking about this moment that I just find so beautiful and interesting that you experienced on the playground in seventh grade. I'm going to guess you were 11 or 12, something like that. You were talking about, you know, kind of feeling a sense of connection and being in a yellow cloud. Was that the only time in your life that you found yourself experiencing that? Or was that, is that an experience that you've had again since then?
I concretely have had what feel like echoes of that moment at other times. When I was at the monastery, I most concretely remember having an experience that feels connected to that, but not the same. And I was walking from the pigs to the sheep.
Okay, okay. Right?
And it was a very normal experience, except for the fact that without the visual element of the cloud, like whatever other sensory experience was in that just felt like it was happening at the same time while I was doing this most mundane thing in the world of going and feeding animals. Mm. And that this work is holy, this work is connected. That's something that I've come back to over and over again. And when I was later in seminary, this is not going where you think it's going, but I had to come up with a metaphor for ministry.
Okay.
And everybody else was coming up with things like translation or connection or, and mine was shoveling manure. It's not something that is high and wonderful. It is the repetitive showing up. Because I was asked by one of the nuns to shovel out the barn every night. Mm-hmm. And in that, I discovered that I was connected to the whole farm. I was connected to the nuns who are going to use the barn the next day and would find it cleaner than it otherwise would be. I was connected to the compost pile where I'd put some of the manure. I was connected to everybody who would eat the crops out of the compost. Like, it was, I was connected to everybody the nuns were praying for, and everybody who had chanted those psalms in the past and would in the future. Like, it was that sort of connection. And in this way, it's like happening in shoveling manure and not this blissful, like, separate from everything connection. Like, no, right. This is happening
right
in the middle of the work.
Yeah, I feel like I remember when my son was really little and I was really in the weeds with, you know, being a new mom, and, you know, he wasn't sleeping well, and we went back to the States to spend a couple months with my family, and we stay in, my family has a little guest house on the farm, and we always stay there, and it doesn't have a dishwasher. So we had, you know, my son was taking bottles. So we had all these bottles and just like clothes with, you know, puke on them that had to be washed. And I remember feeling so overwhelmed and so exhausted and not taking any kind of pleasure in any of it. And one day I had I don't even know what to call it, an epiphany and an awakening where I thought, these are not tasks to be gotten through and crossed off a list so that I can do the things that my life really consists of. This is my life. Washing the dishes is my life. Making sure we all have clean clothes is my life. At the moment, you know, it's not the only thing in life, but as soon as I realized that I could engage in those tasks with my whole heart, instead of wishing the whole time that I didn't have to do them, I really did start to take pleasure in them. And I can totally imagine taking pleasure in shoveling manure.
Yeah. yeah. And at first it was a joke of, like, people would ask me where I was going between Vespers and dinner. Mm-hmm. And I would say, oh, I'm shoveling shit for the glory of God. They would be like, what? I'm like, I'm going to go shovel out the barn. but after a while, it really was like, oh, I really am shoveling shit for the glory of God.
Yeah, let's call it what it is. You said that was an assignment that you had at seminary. Tell us a little bit more about seminary. What was that like?
Seminary was hard and frustrating and wonderful, and I was in classes with people who were fresh out of college, and I'd been out of school for 10 years, mm-hmm. and so many things like that. But and also there were people who were coming in as second or even third career students, mm-hmm. and I was sort of a one and a half career student because my theater career never got off the ground the way I wanted it to. But it was incredibly personally challenging because I was really in every class asked to not have academic distance from what I was trying to engage with. And even if the professor had been fine with that, my classmates would not. And we held each other accountable to approaching what I feel like is the most tender and wonderful thing of like people's lives and how they make meaning of them.
Yeah.
And so we were not perfect, but we were trying really hard to have integrity in that. And then I went into seminary not very politically aware. And I was going to a very politically aware seminary. And when Eric Garner was killed, because that was the summer before seminary, but when his killer was not indicted for his murder, I was broken by that, because I, like, as someone who was like becoming politically aware at a late moment and really invested, and okay, we have the body cam, like we have this camera footage, we have all of this, and then he's not even indicted, and it was devastating for me. And I, for my classmates of color, like, they're like, yeah, this is how the world actually works.
Wow.
Right? They were not surprised.
Now, I know.
They were horrified, but they were not surprised. And I was like a wreck.
Did you engage in any of the protests that took place after that?
I did. I went out to protest, most specifically that night and the night following are the strongest in my memory. For so far as protests that were not set up as a march and everything is proceeding according to plan and all of that. This is the moments where I just found myself pulled onto the street by my heart. And I remember like going out, and it's early evening and it's New York and December and already dark. And at 5 p.m.
Yeah.
or something, because it gets dark so right. early. And just having this moment that of connection to purpose, and just knowing that this is the right place and I need to trust this. And I had never been to any sort of real protest before. I'd been to marches. I'd done things that were manageable. But in an unpermitted protest, you don't know what's going to happen, right? And you have to make peace with the fact that you are showing up and you don't know what you're showing up to. And there was just so much peace in committing to the moment. And just putting myself there and deciding to trust and have faith. And I say this like it was some sort of active decision. It was really... it was just knowing that there was more peace in front of me than behind me. And that if I did not participate, I would not have that peace. Mm. So it was, it is a very strange thing to wind up in the middle of a Black Lives Matter protest while I'm still like working out what it means to be a white woman. And knowing that, that my showing up in this struggle is incredibly important and it's not about me. Mm-hmm. Right? Both of those things. Mm-hmm. That, and that's part of what white people need to do in this moment is learn how to show up in a way that is not about them. And I feel like this is one place where we are always changing and growing, and I probably would not show up to a protest now in the same way that I did 5 years ago, because I have done more work to understand myself as a white person and what feels authentic to me. And I've spent just a lot more time concretely thinking about that. But I remember being in the middle of the street, in the middle of a crowd, in one of the side streets off of Rockefeller Center. And it's the same night as the Christmas tree lighting. And we're trying to shout out the Christmas tree lighting. And it was, so many of us had lost our voices, right? Like we were screaming. And I have this moment of, we're screaming, hands up, don't shoot, mm-hmm. right? After Michael Brown in Ferguson. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, it's like somebody else had dropped out and I had been one of the people who picked up the hands up part. So the leading mm-hmm. of the mm-hmm. chant, right? And I just found myself naturally picking it up because we needed it to carry forward. And all of a sudden, like I am embodying this moment of a white person threatening a crowd of Black people and people who are allied with Black people. And I'm doing it for them. Well, no, that's not right. I'm doing it for all of us. I'm doing it for myself too. And mm-hmm. I was just overwhelmed with the racial tension in myself mm-hmm. of needing to work through who I am as a person in order to show up with authenticity in this moment. And I really don't have a moment to do it. So I drop the chant for a sec, and one of the people who is near me says, "Don't stop. You still have a voice." Mm. Because so many people had yelled themselves hoarse already and could not carry the chant forward. And and so I filed this moment away to be like, okay, I need to do my white identity work tomorrow.
Yeah. Don't wait any longer.
Not right here. Well, I need to do it tomorrow, but I can't do it tonight.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Right? And so I carried it forward, right? And then the next night, I showed up again. And I showed up with cough drops for everybody, right?
Because we
all need our voices.
Exactly, exactly. Rachel, we're going to take another short break and we'll be right back to continue our conversation. It is such a pleasure to share our interviews with you each week, and your feedback means the world to us. Let us know which episodes you're enjoying most and what you hope to hear in the future. I'm also hoping you'll subscribe to our podcast. When you rate and review your favorite episodes, it helps to widen our audience and bring more people into the fold. You can find us on social media and check out the new Listen blog on our website at thelistenpodcast.com. We're talking today with Rachel Hayes about her spiritual journey and her path to becoming a Unitarian Universalist minister. Rachel, I really want to use the balance of our conversation to talk about what you've already begun to talk about when it comes to specifically the Black Lives Matter movement. And I really want to take advantage of this time with you to ask you, as one white Midwestern woman, American woman, to another white Midwestern American woman, what is our role in all of this?
I think we have many roles, and I think that every person needs to find a way to be responsible for themselves in this moment. And my experience is just like finding the piece on the sidewalk that is like two paces ahead of me, mm-hmm. right? And is that our work is a little bit more than we're comfortable with. Mm. And I want to encourage people to, and most especially white people in this, because that is what I feel like I have to offer most, is to encourage white people to consider this as the movement for Black Lives is essential to the spiritual wholeness of white people. Mm-hmm. It absolutely is. And just like I grew up Catholic with the structures of Catholicism and the different waves of migration and all of this surrounding me and informing me in ways that I did not understand, white people have largely unexamined racial knowledge within themselves, right? We have so much information about this that we have not processed. Mm-hmm. And it is absolutely true that the police in this country were formed to terrorize people of color and protect the property of the wealthy, mm-hmm. who were de facto white, mm-hmm. right? Like, that is where policing has come from. Mm-hmm. And in this moment, as we are so aware of the deaths of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, Tony McDade, it is so important for us to understand what it means to be known as a white person in this culture and the privilege we have in being able to go to our city council and be taken seriously. Mm-hmm. It lands differently when a white person says we need to defund the police than when a black person says it, mm-hmm. right? We experience that differently, and therefore more white people need to be saying mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. And so that might be for some white people showing up in protest, and for anyone who chooses to do that, please do so safely in terms of this pandemic moment. Mm-hmm. Remember to wear your mask, keep your distance when you can, clean your hands. All of these things will continue to be good ideas. Yes. But something that will be true at any Black Lives Matter protest is to follow the leadership of Black people. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know who the Black people to follow are in this moment, that's your first part of the work, mm-hmm. right? Like, there are Black organizers in every city. You can look up your local Black Lives Matter chapter. You can find the people who are doing the work on an ongoing basis, even between protests, and figure out from their social media, from what they are putting out with no extra work for them, what you can do to help, mm-hmm. right? And if that is showing up and being a wall of white people between police and Black people, go for mm-hmm. it, as you're requested to do mm-hmm. so, right? Also, if that is writing checks, this is a great time to write checks mm-hmm. to Black-led organizations. Mm-hmm. And that is something that white people absolutely can and should be doing. If you have the privilege of enough money to see you through the next month or so, maybe something should be coming out of your bank account mm-hmm. to help in this struggle.
Those are great, great pieces of advice and so practical. I find it I think it's important to talk about, to philosophize and to have opinions and to have insights. But anytime you can break things down into practical steps, I just find so, so helpful. So I'm sure that there are listeners out there who will be very grateful for what you've offered. Rachel, where do you see your path leading you? I was going to say as a minister, I would imagine that's a little hard to separate from, as a person. But where do you see your life heading? What do you see yourself doing in the future?
Well, I have just begun my ministry here in Massachusetts. This is my first year. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As a full-time minister, and it is, so I'm here for a while. Yeah. I have no plans to leave. I am figuring out how to stay connected with my people right now. And yesterday we had, there was a vigil on our town common. And I saw several of my congregants there. And it was the first time I had seen them in person in months. And what we're learning now about COVID-19, it's not quite so scary to run into people outside. So that's nice, right? Yeah,
especially as you said, if you're wearing masks, I find that really helpful to see, you know, images of protests and vigils with people who are doing what they can to be safe, to be physically safe, wearing masks.
I see myself with this congregation and figuring out ways to grow more where we are, right? So that, I mean, I think that they're going to continue to get justice sermons from me. And I look forward to finding more ways to show up meaningfully with them. Something that I didn't mention before is that a large part of what I did after those first, like, hugely powerful protests was to be one of the people leading my congregation, or my home congregation, Fourth Universalist, where I went to church, right, into racial justice work together. It was important to me that I not just show up myself, but to connect the congregation to this work, right? And I'm not the only person who was involved in that. I won't take that credit. But we did connect that congregation to racial justice work in a way that had not been happening. And that connection has continued. And so what I look for and is a way to connect my congregation now in this time where it's really hard to connect in any way to the struggle for more justice in the world. So I think that we have a lot of work to do there, and it feels different to have this, to navigate this moment in bucolic Massachusetts, as opposed to New York City. So I am excited and also feeling like this is new water and the conversation is a little different because it is a different setting and a different group of people. And we have vigils and rallies, and the trick here is not letting that be the end.
Yeah. Well, those are inspiring words. And Rachel, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join me today. It's been a real pleasure hearing all about your journey, and I wish you and your family all the best.
Thank you, Kate. It's been so wonderful to spend some time with you today.
This concludes our series of interviews focusing on religion and spirituality. Many thanks to Sarah Ronan, Arun Deva, and Rachel Hayes for their generous contributions. The Listen podcast is produced and recorded in Cuenca, Spain, which is located between the Júcar and Huecar rivers. Check out our archives at thelistenpodcast.com. There are 6 full seasons waiting for you there, all free and easy to access.
Lauren Lovett is our producer. Caitlin Fisher handles our social media, and Lidia Munoz Solera writes our blog. Editing, tech support, and original music are courtesy of Lucas Munoz Jetmore. I'm Kate Jetmore, and this is Listen.